Chapter 3. Elith surveyed the vast array of gear laid out before her, a magnificent display of the Hezra's technological ingenuity and power. There seemed to be a tool or gadget to cover every possible situation one might meet in an unexplored land, and many more that had such specialized purpose she couldn't fathom why someone had gone to the trouble to design it. The only thing conspicuously missing was any sort of weapon. The Hezra procurement officer waited patiently, answered her questions politely, made his recommendations humbly, as though he were guiding her through his finest selection of wines. It was all on offer for her to equip herself as she saw fit for the task ahead. Nieta stood nearby, silently observing. The moment after Elith had agreed to join the task force, a whirlwind of activity had swept her along so quickly that she barely had time to process how radically the decision had altered the direction of her life. Her change of heart had happened almost unconsciously, reflexively. Nieta's forbidden revelation had shocked her, of course, but beyond that, it had transformed in her mind the reality of the situation they were facing. Sardis had made it abundantly clear in both his words and his displeasure with Nieta that the Paragon's disappearance was to be kept utterly secret. Arbiter Oyun had already known, which told Elith how highly ranked the man was, even within the obviously top-tier structure that had been put in place for this secretive operation. Officially, however, the mission was one of scientific investigation and intelligence gathering, not search and rescue. It still wasn't clear to Elith what its true unofficial purpose was. She took her time selecting her loadout for the expedition. No one could tell her how long they expected to be on Quell's Shadow, nor what they might find there. During her service to the house, she'd been through the same process countless times, predicting the unpredictable, evaluating her likely needs against the cost of weight and bulk. The main difference now was that she wouldn't be operating alone. Elith didn't yet know how many others she would be joining, and still no one had explained to her what role she was expected to play. But she could guess. She would study the planet as only an advocate of the voice could, and then, if called upon, she would kill it. It was her experience with Quell that set her apart from any of her former sisters, and she suspected that was the key that the Hezra needed and that only she possessed. After she'd completed her preparations, the procurement officer took careful inventory and informed her that he'd personally oversee the transfer of her equipment to the ship they'd be traveling on. Elith thanked him and joined Nieta. "Sardis is assembling the team at the staging area," Nieta said. "I imagine he'll have some sort of speech prepared." Elith nodded, and the two left the armory, Nieta leading the way. The silence between them felt strained, its edges bulging beneath the weight of all that they wanted to say to each other. Elith sensed that neither of them knew how to begin, or perhaps both feared that once begun, they would not know how to stop. As they rode together in a lift, though, Elith finally brought herself to test the boundaries. "Are you going to call me Exile for this entire trip?" Elith asked. Nieta remained silent long enough for Elith to think that she wouldn't respond. But then she spoke. "I don't know," Nieta said. "It is hard to be with you." She paused and looked down. After a moment, she shook her head, looked to Elith, and added, "But it was harder to be without you." Tears rimmed her eyes, and Elith felt her heart stir. In her long exile, she'd worked to set the memories of her past life aside, to drain them of their emotional significance and mark them as dead. Here, now, reunited with Nieta, the warmth and bonds of sisterhood rekindled unexpectedly, and she found tears of her own rising in response. "I did miss you, Nieta," she said. I don't regret my choice, but I am deeply sorry for the pain it caused you. Nieta returned her gaze to the doors of the lift, the bitterness of the wound overshadowing any lingering bond she might have felt with Elith. The pain wasn't just mine, Nieta said. I'll never understand how you could abandon the house after all it has done for you. You would, Elith replied, if you understood all I had done for it. They lapsed into sharp silence for a few seconds more, the quiet hum of the lift providing the only buffer to soften the edge. Nieta could not have known the truth of what the Paragon had put Elith through, nor of the confrontation between them. Least of all, could she have suspected how Elith had prevailed in that final test. Even if Elith explained it, Nieta would never believe it. The gulf between them was too great, and the distance was magnified by the closeness Elith had felt only a moment before. I still don't know how you found me, Elith offered. I'm not sure we ever would have on our own, Nieta said, but we had help. They arrived at the proper deck, and the doors slid open before Elith could ask more. A long, wide hangar stretched before them, buzzing with crew. Nieta led her out, walking a few steps ahead of her at a pace that made it clear she didn't want to continue the conversation. It would have been difficult to do so anyway, given the amount of activity on the deck. As they walked, Elith saw three ships aligned and waiting on launch platforms, and it appeared that all of them were being prepared for deployment. The largest of the three had a less aggressive bearing than the others, and though it was clearly of military design, several of the external features gave Elith the impression that it was primarily a research vessel. The two smaller craft seemed like siblings, one larger, bulkier, the other lean and scrappy. A transport and its supporting gunship. For a science expedition, the Hezra was going in heavy. Pallets of supplies and equipment lay neatly arranged near each ship, and Hezra crew members moved efficiently to load and ready the vessels. Judging by the look of it all, Elith guessed their launch window was fast approaching. And based on the size of the craft and the way they were being prepped, she noted that none of them were equipped with aspect drives. Ascendance vessels of sufficient class used Hezra-engineered aspect drives to cross vast distances near instantaneously. That the three vessels lacked drives of their own told her one of two things. Either they were already within their launch range of Quell's shadow, or their current vessel would be serving as their mothership for the operation. That also meant that once they launched, they'd be dependent on the greater ship's support for their return. Nieta continued on through the middle of it all, to the far side of the hangar opposite the bay doors. There they passed through a double-sealed chamber that opened to a short corridor, which was lined with a pair of cabins on either side. They entered one of these, and from the proximity to the hangar and the layout of the space itself, Elith identified it as a final point of assembly for crew and troopers before deployment. Compared to other cabins she'd seen on the vessel, this one felt quite large and had been designed with mixed purpose. The front third was arrayed with perhaps 40 or 50 seats arranged in gently curving rows, focused around a raised platform, equipped for formal briefings. But the rest of the space had an almost recreational atmosphere. The middle portion was casually furnished, comfortable seating arranged in various clusters, with a few stations for refreshments scattered throughout. The rear of the room was mostly open space, and there Sardis stood talking with two other men alongside a metallic cubic container that Elith took to be some sort of special supply crate.
Ah, good, Sardis said when he saw them. Our guests of honor.
He waved them over. The two women crossed the space to join the group.
This is my agent in charge of security, the envoy said, introducing the man on his right. Wari Korush. The instant she'd seen him, Elith had identified the man as an Azirim, a member of the force that served as elite bodyguards for both Hezra command personnel and Ascendant's Grand Council dignitaries. He was short and wiry, with head shaved bald and the braided beard iconic of the Aziri, groomed with acute precision. Even in his relaxed stance, his bearing made him seem as hard as an iron rail, a man of stone made flesh. A thin strap across his chest held sheathed a rare and storied weapon, a technological wonder the Hezra called a void edge. It was the size and shape of a wide-bladed field knife, worn high near the shoulder with the grip downward. Elith knew it was a fearful device, granted only to certain members of the Aziri, but hadn't ever seen one in person. But for all the impact the man himself made, it was the name that marked him most in her mind. Wari was not only name, but also title, identifying him as one of an extremely small group within the Aziri. To carry the name of Wari was to be trusted and skilled enough to serve as personal guard for the Hezra Ka himself. The select group had much in common with First House's own advocates of the voice, though their purpose and training were completely different. Though Elith had met a few Aziri before, she'd never encountered one of this man's status. They were peers in a way, most trusted and most burdened in service to their sovereigns. Korush bowed crisply, the perfect demonstration of courtesy and respect. But Elith could read in his eyes an emotion directly opposed to his display. There was no doubt he considered her an enemy. She returned the bow, but didn't offer her own name. It was clear that everyone here already knew who she was. "And his little pet machine god," Sardis added. "I forgot its designation." The crate beside them stirred. Elith took a reflexive step back at the motion as the cube-like shape softly clattered and expanded, its once solid exterior swarming and shifting into a vaguely humanoid-shaped mass of technology, like the blurred shadow of a man. "Its designation is Subo," it said, its voice polite and quiet, tonally identical to that of a human. It towered over her, standing a few inches taller than even Sardis. She saw now that what she'd initially taken to be large square panels of metal were actually comprised of hundreds, possibly thousands, of individual components, intricately tessellated with no sign of how they were joined or held together. Apart from speech and the astonishing ability to shift shape, Elith had no idea what its other capabilities were. Given what she knew of the Hezra's capacity, there was little doubt that it was a weapons platform of dire magnitude. The man on Sardis's left chuckled at her reaction. "Don't worry. It won't bite," he said, "unless Korush tells it to." He was dark-haired and dark-eyed, and from his build and uniform, Elith could tell he was a Hezra officer who spent more time in the field than in command centers. He had a casual demeanor at odds with the usual tight professionalism of Hezra troopers, like a man on vacation in the midst of a war council. His uniform bore no identifying insignia. He stepped forward to greet the two women. "Captain Ames," he said with a broad smile and an informal bow. "Pleasure to meet you finally." Elith returned the greeting and realized he was talking specifically to her. "Finally," she said.
"Yeah, I'd hoped to do it a lot earlier, but I just never could quite catch up with you."
There was a playful glint in his eye that suggested some inside joke or deeper meaning that she missed. But Sardis didn't give them time to talk more.
"Ames will be primary navigation once we're on world," he said. "But for the moment, he'll be setting up for the final briefing while the rest of us talk."
"Sure thing," Ames said, taking the dismissal without skipping a beat.
He smiled at both Nieta and Elith again, gave a quick bow, and then headed off toward the front area. Sardis waited,
until Ames had busied himself setting up the station for the upcoming final briefing before continuing with the others.
"I'll be bringing in the rest of our segment shortly," he said. "Before I do, Exile, I thought perhaps I should afford you the chance to reconsider now that you've had some time to contemplate matters more fully. Even now, you are under no obligation. But once we depart from this ship, you will be committed. There will be no turning back until our task is done. For any of us." He wouldn't say it aloud, but it was clear enough that he truly didn't want her on the team. Though it defied her understanding, Elith knew what authority must have demanded it of him. Only the Hezra-Ka wielded such power over an envoy.
"I committed when I made my choice," Elith replied.
"Which choice?" Sardis asked. "The first or the second? You seemed so certain each time it's hard for me to be sure."
"Envoy," she said, "I'll hold up my end of the deal. You need worry only about keeping yours."
He rocked back on his heels, disappointed and resigned.
"Indeed," he said. "Very well. I suppose we should get on with it then. Karush!"
Subo folded itself back into its cubic form with a soft-edged clicking as its articulated outer shell reconfigured. The process was disconcertingly fast, like watching a tree decay in time-lapse. Elith got the distinct impression that the machine's initial self-presentation had been for her benefit, a threat implied. Others began filtering into the room as the rest of the team started to arrive. Arbiter Oyun was among them, a few of his staff in tow. He waved, to Elith specifically, it seemed, but he was in continued conversation with one of those at his side, and his face remained serious with concentration.
"For the sake of our little group, we're going to have to find something else to call you besides Exile," Sardis said. "A handful of us know your identity, but it's already difficult enough for some to cope with having members of the First House embedded with their unit. There's no need to alarm them further. Advocate, do you have an acceptable alternative?"
Nieta looked at Elith for a long moment, wrestling with the decision. Any title would suggest a certain standing within the house, and according to law and tradition, it was forbidden to honor an exile with the name they'd been granted by its elders. But Elith could see, too, that there was something more going on.
"Let her have her own name," Nieta finally said. "I'll not speak it. But as a token of our grace and hope that she'll fulfill her promises, the others may. As far as they're concerned, she is an aspirant. My attendant."
"Fine," Sardis said flatly. He turned abruptly, headed toward the front of the room. "I suggest you both sit in the back."
Karush bowed to them both and followed Sardis, leaving the two women alone. Elith turned then to Nieta. Though it had been lost on the others, she knew what it meant for the older woman to permit the use of her name.
"Thank you," Elith said.
"Earn it," Nieta answered, "and perhaps one day to utter it won't be such a curse in our halls."
She walked away and made her way to a seat in the rearmost row of the briefing area. Elith followed after her and sat beside her, readily adopting the humble position of attendant that Nieta had assigned to her. Though Elith had once held the higher rank and standing in the Order of the Voice, it was no matter to her ego to now be considered the lesser of the two. At least, it would make it easier to fade into the background, to be overlooked and underestimated by those who did not know her already. Over the next few minutes, the remainder of the team members joined the assembly. Several people glanced their way as they entered, but most showed no sign of recognition or even interest. Elith watched the way they self-organized as they filed into the briefing area, and without conscious effort began mapping the connections she could infer. There were about half as many people as seats, perhaps 40 or so, and though they might all have been Hezra, the clusters they formed and the quiet conversations within them revealed some of the boundaries between those gathered.
Even among the troopers, she picked up clear signs of the professional but subtle testing that always happened when top-tier veterans first met. It was obvious that personnel had been drawn together from a variety of units to create the task force. She noticed, too, how Captain Ames moved easily among the groups, greeting several by name and receiving equal welcome from the disparate groups. Elith couldn't tell if his widespread recognition was personal or by reputation only, but either way, he was clearly both respected and liked by a majority of the team. The opposite appeared to be true for Nyetta and Elith. Though no one looked their way or made any audible remarks about them, it also seemed to be no accident that the two rows in front of them remained empty. Sardis stepped up onto the platform at the front of the room and activated two large holographic displays, and the conversations dwindled to silence in a matter of seconds. One display showed a standard Hezra operation order, listing key details about timing, communication protocols, and command structure. On the other sat a full-screen view of the target planet from close orbit. It was vivid in green and blue, splashed and streaked here and there with the white of clouds. Inviting. Nothing about it suggested its anomalous origin, or the threat it represented. The envoy took a few moments to carefully scan the individuals gathered before him, his eyes resting on each long enough to suggest he was either comparing each face against a mental checklist or that he was memorizing them for future reference. When he reached Nyetta and Elith, however, his gaze brushed past them, almost as if they weren't there.
"Each of you gathered here has been hand-selected for this task because of your service to and your standing within the Hezra hierarchy," Sardis began.
If that statement had been intended to serve as praise or recognition, he undercut the sentiment immediately with his next one.
"So I'm not going to waste time going over the details that you should have already reviewed in the packages you were issued. One item bears mentioning, however, that has not, up until this point, been disclosed. Ours is not the first deployment to Ru-Het 1117. We will be the second attempt to conduct such an operation on the world."
An intense silence gripped the room. No murmurs or whispers, though in the quick exchange of looks among several troopers, Elith could read the surprise and the questions raised.
"First House volunteered a number of personnel to serve as an advance scouting party. To aid them, we provided a Hezra asset of some value. We have no further information to share on the composition of the first task force, nor on its outcomes, other than to say it was a House-led initiative. You may notice that we're running the operation this time, and infer from that what you will."
Sardis didn't look to the back row when he said it, but the chuckles and quiet comments throughout the room left no doubt that he'd meant to ensure that Elith and Nyetta knew their place within the group.
Now, he said, in mock conciliation, "we all serve the Ascendants in our own particular ways, some more than others, perhaps, but certainly we appreciate the support of the First House."
Here, he gestured to Nyetta and Elith.
"They have graciously supplied us with two advisors, Nyetta of the First House of the Ascendants, Advocate of the Voice."
Several heads turned to look their way now, and a few murmurs signaled the recognition of Nieta's special status. Though advocates of the hand and the eye regularly interacted with Hezra personnel, Elith doubted that anyone in the room had ever had direct contact with an advocate of the voice before.
"And her attendant," Sardis continued, as though it were a throwaway comment. "You can address her as aspirant, I believe. They will be attached to Captain Ames's group for the duration to serve in an advisory capacity."
He emphasized the term, though whether it was for Elith's sake or the rest of the team wasn't apparent. Captain Ames turned around in his seat
and gave the two women in the back row a broad smile and a genuine salute. Whatever anyone else might think of them, at least they seemed to have an ally in him. Elith still wasn't sure why.
The quarantine fleet is stationed at standard intervals, 5 light seconds from 1117, Sardis said, the displays shifting behind him to show a strategic representation as he spoke.
We will stage deployment 4.5 light seconds from the forward line, and we will be making a direct line jump to that point of departure.
The general reaction to the statement was one of restrained surprise, a feeling Elith shared with the others. It meant they were not yet within their launch range to the planet and would be using their aspect drive to reach their designated deployment point. But that was not the part that had surprised the members of the task force. Due to the great power and method of operation of the aspect drives, standard protocol called for transitions to be made in areas of space with substantial distance from any significant gravity wells. Final approach was always completed on standard radiant propulsion. In this case, however, it seemed they would be transitioning directly to proximity with their target world, an unusual and potentially dangerous maneuver. But Sardis gave the reason for its necessity.
In case it was not made abundantly clear in your materials, Sardis continued, our involvement in this matter is unknown to the hierarchy at large and should remain so. Our unorthodox travel plans should help mask our arrival. And if all goes according to specification, our subsequent departure will also go unremarked upon. When we reach our destination, we will deploy immediately. Following dismissal from here, each team should proceed to its assigned vessel and prepare for the shift. Clariana will serve as our command craft and will remain in synchronous orbit for the duration. Atarin and Vanquin are our surface crafts. Teams assigned to those vessels should expect to make first landing and then be prepared to stay on planet until our work is completed. From the moment we deploy, we will be on task. If any of you are feeling apprehensive about what lies ahead, I can provide you the following reassurances. I assure you that our progress will be slow, that our task will be difficult, and that the risks to our personal lives will be extreme. There is no way to know how long it will take for us to perform our survey, nor to predict what we will encounter while we do so. If you require any further reassurance, you signed up for the wrong job.
Sardis paused and scanned the group again in his manner, as though judging for himself each individual's resolve. This time, however, when he reached the back row, he locked eyes with Elith and held her gaze for long seconds. She did not look away.
I cannot overstate the significance of this operation, he said, finally addressing the group as a whole. The Hezra Ka is watching.
That final statement apparently served as Sardis's dismissal. He closed the displays and stepped off the platform, headed directly for the exit. The expectation was clear enough. Apart from a few sensitive details, the teams had all been briefed in advance, and the assumption was that they were prepared for immediate deployment. All that remained now was to board their respective ships and wait for the signal to launch. The members of the task force moved into crisp action with little conversation. Elith alone, it seemed, had been left without clear instruction. As the personnel filed out of the room, though, Captain Ames remained to one side. Nieta and Elith joined him and stood by until they were the only ones remaining.
It's my privilege to have you both under my care for the trip, he said. But I think it's probably wise to take it slow for the first little while. These guys are all pretty slipstream, used to moving fast and not having to deal with a lot of overhead and baggage. They're going to sniff around you a bit, to figure out how much trouble you're going to be. Try not to take it personally. I don't think it'll take them long, though, once they see how good you are on the ground. And word to the wise,
Politeness is not generally among their skill set. But with certain folks, it doesn't hurt to be able to give as good as you get.
We'll follow your lead, Captain Ames, Nieta said. Not too closely, I hope, he replied with a wink. I'm kind of a knucklehead.
He gestured toward the door and escorted the two women to their waiting ship. As was to be expected, the majority of the personnel were boarding the largest vessel, Clariana, but Ames took them past it to the smaller transport, dubbed Atterin. Though his encouraging aside had seemed motivated solely by his friendly nature, Elith noted the separation it had opened between them and the rest of the team they were joining. Clearly that had been part of his plan. The man was sharper than he purported to be. By the time they arrived at the ship, everyone else had already taken their places closest to the rear hatch, leaving the forwardmost seats available. Ames led Elith and Nieta up the center aisle, through the midst of the team, past the empty seats, all the way to the front. When they reached the farthest seats, he directed them to sit there. Elith glanced down the length of the vessel. She estimated the Atterin had capacity for 40 or so, and a quick count put the team at a dozen troopers, excluding Ames and the ship's crew. It was impossible to ignore the number of empty seats the captain was putting between his troopers and the women of the house.
VIP status, Ames said with a smile
in response to Elith's glance. Your kindness is appreciated, Captain, Nieta said, but so is your candor. His smile shifted sideways, good-humored, even with the breaking of his polite fiction. He looked at the men and women at the back of the ship.
They've got a lot to deal with right now. I figured it's best to let them run their usual routine as much as possible, without having three walk-ons in the middle of it.
Three,
Elith said. Ames looked back at them and gave a quick nod.
Joint op. I'm a guest, same as you. Well, not quite the same. They all know me well enough. But it's not business as usual for any of us.
Anyway, don't worry. We'll get all mixed in together soon enough.
For now, go ahead and get settled in. I'm going to check in with the crew real quick. Once we make the shift, things are going to move pretty fast. So try to relax while you can.
He slipped off toward the cockpit, leaving the two monastics to buckle in for the journey ahead. Despite all the questions that still swirled in Elith's mind, she didn't try to speak with Nieta. The details would come in due time, and the order in which they were provided to her would tell a story of its own. As unimaginable as it had been only hours before, it was now clear to Elith why the house and the Hezra had gone to such incredible lengths to find her. They were being deployed to confront whatever the first team had encountered there. And Elith couldn't ignore the fact that no one had called it a rescue mission. The implications sat heavy upon her. The relative hush as they waited told of the gravity the others felt as well. Apart from a few quiet comments, there was none of the casual banter or good-natured ribbing she would have expected from the troopers at the back of the ship. A few minutes after he'd disappeared, Captain Ames returned, but passed by without addressing them. He took a seat in the middle of the craft, alone, with space between both parties, maintaining his neutrality, or perhaps reinforcing his position as a bridge between them. It was roughly an hour before Elith felt the subtle shift in her sense of time and place that signified the activation of their mothership's aspect drive as it transported them across an unknown distance to within half a light second of Quell's shadow. She knew Nieta had also sensed it, and she knew, too, that no one else aboard the vessel had the capacity to do so. The aspect drive was the great gift of Hezra technology that had opened the path to the Ascendance's expansion throughout the galaxy, making trivial the interstellar distances that had once been incomprehensible. And though Elith didn't know the exact mechanism behind the drive's operation, she knew well enough its foundation. The device drew upon the limitless potential of the cosmos, just as she did when she spoke the deep language. and though the two methods of contact to that source were vastly different, those trained in the arts of the first house possessed a special sensitivity to its use. Less than a minute after the shift, the interior lights dimmed and switched to red, signaling imminent deployment. The craft was silent with waiting.
"Hold up,"
a gruff voice eventually said from the rear.
"I forgot to pack socks."
The comment was perfectly timed. At almost the same moment that the last words had been uttered, the acceleration of the launch pressed them into their seats. A couple of chuckles sounded in the cabin and then fell silent again, any further commentary lost in the deep hum of the ship as it made for its destination under radiant propulsion. Sardis had told them that once they launched, there would be no turning back. And though Elith had meant it when she'd said she was committed, as the distance between the mothership and their tiny vessel stretched open, she felt the familiar fear of the unknown rising within her to match it. She herself had once beheld the full strength of the Paragon and had scarcely withstood it. Now she would discover what terrible power existed within the universe that might dwarf even that of the ancient matriarch of the first house of the Ascendants. And as the distance between them and that mysterious planet diminished, so too did her confidence that any of them would survive.